Bless you. Okay, so let's get started. So, a few things I just wanted to mention. I would like more questions and discussions in class, just to for you to make sure you understand the material and for me to get a gauge on where you stand with your understanding. Last time I think there were very few questions. I prefer not to be a lecturer. I would like you to just learn the material by more interactions, okay, in the class. So as an incentive today, I'm going to, anyone who speaks up, I'll give some candy out. Okay. So I just brought a bunch of it here. My son thinks this is the best thing ever. If he feels that if his school teacher gives out candy for asking questions, his life is done. But because he has to get to college before then. Okay. In any case, I mean, just aside, it's very important to make sure you're understanding the material. Today is going to be the first real lecture. We'll talk about processes. There will be several key concepts that I'm going to teach. And if you don't understand it, you will have problems understanding subsequent material and or completing the programming assignment. Okay, so just feel free absolutely to ask questions at any point. Okay, this is a quick recap of what we did last time, just to sort of spend a minute on it. So we were talking about a broad brush overview of an operating system kernel. So I mentioned several components that any operating system needs to implement, any operating system kernel, which, and these are components that deal with processes and threads, memory management, file system and I/O, okay, and networking and distributed systems. Yeah, what I also talked about were what were the hardware abstractions that an operating system uses to provide certain services and what the user sees. Okay, so just to give an example, you have a processor on the machine, the OS that provides you various functionalities such as process management, scheduling, accounting, synchronization and so on. What the user sees are processes, okay, and threads. These are applications that are actually running on the machine. Okay, so we looked at that in the context of memory, I/O devices, file systems, distributed systems and so on. Okay. I also mentioned several important architectural principles that kernels use, starting with a monolithic kernel. This is just one large blob of kernel code that executes all components are part of this one process. I said that this is efficient because any component can efficiently interact with any other component using function calls, but not necessarily modular and easy to maintain. Okay, so we looked at several alternatives, starting with the layered design. Microkernel architectures where you have a bare bone kernels and all components are actually user processes. Okay, all OS components are implemented as system processes. All that the microkernel is doing is giving bare bone protection features and inter-process communication. Okay, and we ended by looking at the modular design where you might have a monolithic kernel, for you may prefer to implement a monolithic kernel for performance reasons, but for ease of maintaining your kernel code, you implement components as modules that can be plugged in and plugged out of the kernel. Okay, so those are things to keep in mind. Okay, so let me sort of now say a little bit about what we are going to do today. So today's lecture is going to focus on processes. Okay, we'll talk about what is a process. Okay, how does the operating system deal with processes? What are the various execution states of a process? How does it transition from one state to another? How are processes created and destroyed by the operating systems? And last, we'll talk briefly about how processes communicate with one another. Okay, and then how can that be made efficient? So let's start with the first of those bullets, which is what's a process. Okay? So last time I briefly described what a process is. I said intuitively it is basically a program in execution. Okay? So a more formal definition is up there, which says it's the dynamic execution context of an executing program. Okay? Several processes may be running or executing the same program. Okay? Program is basically code that you write that resides on disk. It may be machine code that your compiler has generated. When you run this program, you get a process. Okay, that is basically the execution context of that program. So several processes may run the same program, but each is a distinct process with its own state. A process is by process we mean something that executes sequentially, one assembly instruction at a time. I'll come back to this in just a moment. And so you have a process that's executing sequentially, and its state consists of all of this. The state consists of the code that you have for the program, consists of any static data for the program, any constants that you have declared in the program. Space for the dynamic data, which is the heap for the program. If you have programmed in any programming language, you probably know a little bit about the heap, more so if you are programmed in C, C++, and less so if you do Java. But in either case, whenever you do either new or malloc or anything like that, you are allocating more memory. All of that memory of your process actually sits on this piece of memory region called the heap. You have the program counter, which is a register that points to the instruction, the next instruction that the process needs to execute. There is a stack. The stack is essentially the program's call chain. It's basically all the functions that have called recursively. And so the state of each of that functions is represented in a piece of memory called a stack. Then the state of the process also consists of all the registers, as well as other things like the memory management state and so on. So there may be open files, and the last but not least, there is a state, is an execution state associated with the process that we'll talk about. So all of this constitutes the state of this process. So it's essentially everything that the process has in memory, everything that the process has in registers, all of the files that are opened by the process, as well as what is the process currently doing, what is its execution state. So collectively, all of these pieces of information is what we will refer to as the state of that process. We'll talk more about this as we go along. So here is an example of how a process is represented in memory. So let's assume this is some code you have written. This is in C. Even if you don't know C, this is just easy to understand. There's a main function and there's another function X. And currently your process is executing that statement. This is how the process is laid out in memory. This is the code segment. This is the part of memory where your program is actually loaded. Now clearly you will have assembly instruction, not C code, that is loaded in memory, but just for conceptual reason, let's assume it is C code. The program counter is a register that points to what instruction to execute next. This is the stack. So the stack actually consists, the stack consists of all the functions. So here you have main, that's how you start the process. And then when you come here, you call function X. So now you are in function X. So there is state of the main function, the state of function X. These are the local variables in each of the functions, so they are all part of the stack. If the process actually allocates memory dynamically, you also have the heap. So that's another region of memory. So there are at least three key segments: the code segment, the stack segment, and the heap segment. So all of this have to be created by the OS. Memory has to be allocated to it when you start the process. When you actually start executing it, you have to load that code, you have to allocate memory to do all of these other things, the stack and the heap and so on. Is that clear? Okay, so I mentioned this process execution state. The execution state of a process indicates what it is doing currently. Any process in your system can be in one of these five states. Starting with the new state, and then you have the running and the ready state, waiting, and the terminated state. The name should indicate what that state is. Whenever you start a new process, when you, let's say, double click on an icon, or you start off a script, or you start something from the command line, the OS creates a new process. And the process is at that point in the new state, because what the OS is doing is it's loading the program from disk into memory, setting up the memory regions and doing all of the initial bookkeeping. So any process that you start up will be in the new state. And once the process has been loaded and the OS is actually ready to execute instructions, it is going to move into a ready state. In the ready state, it is not yet running on the CPU, but it just indicates to the kernel that it is now ready to run. So at some later point, the OS is actually going to sort of schedule this process for execution on the processor, okay, which means it's going to get CPU time, it can actually start running. Okay. At that point, it will transition to running state. Okay. You will see that there's an arrow that goes from ready to running and back from running to ready. Okay. So each process gets a certain amount of CPU time, and when that time expires, the process has to give up the CPU for some other processing. So it will go back to the ready state, waiting for its turn next on the CPU. So it may transition from ready to running for arbitrary number of times. If at any point, okay, when it's actually running on the CPU, the process starts doing I/O. If either tries to read from the terminal, I mean, it tries to write something to the console, it tries to read from a file, it tries to read what you type on your keyboard, it will actually go into that waiting state. In the waiting state, a process is trying to do I/O. Okay, in the running state, it's executing on the CPU. Yeah, so from running, if at any point you do anything that triggers I/O, then the process goes into the waiting state. When the I/O completes, okay, it is going to go back to the ready state, because at that point the I/O is done. It can start running. It is ready to run again. Okay, so it will go back here. It may get chosen to run again. So it will actually cycle through these states, yeah, until the process is done. Okay, if you either quit your application or the process finishes execution, then it will go into the terminated state. At this point, the OS will start deallocating the memory that was allocated to the process and so on. And once that is done, the process just disappears from the system. Okay? So it is important to understand what are the states of a process, and even more important to keep this picture in mind. Okay? What are the transitions that a process can make? So you can go from new to ready, and then from ready to running and back. Okay, and then from running, you can also go to waiting to do I/O. Once you are done with I/O, come back to the ready state and cycle through the states. And then you will go into the terminated state once you are done. Okay. So those are the process execution states. Okay. So now, just to understand how this might apply to any specific process, let's take a trivial program, okay, which is basically the main program that just does one thing. It prints hello world and it exits. Okay? So now you can ask, what are the states that the process goes through? Okay, what is the sequence of states? That's the state transition diagram for any arbitrary process. So then the question is, what transitions does this program make when you start it up? Okay? So you have to basically follow that state transition diagram, see what this process is doing, and make it go through the appropriate transitions. Okay. So clearly, it's going to, when you start it up, it is going to be in the new state. Okay, then what is going to happen next? Okay, so it will go into the ready state. And then what happens? Okay, then what? What is it doing? So it is ready. Then what will it do next? Okay, it has to run. Okay, it will start executing on the CPU. Okay, so it will get some CPU time. So it will run. What instruction will it execute? The sprint instruction. Okay, that's an I/O instruction. So as soon as it starts running and it executes this instruction, it will immediately start doing I/O. Okay, so then it will go back to wait state. Yeah, so remember, it can't go directly from ready to wait. It has to actually execute that instruction. Then it will block and start doing I/O. So it will block until this printf completes. Okay? Yes, question. What would make it terminate? Once this process finishes, it will terminate. The process is not done yet, right? So it is basically executing printf. Printf causes it to wait so that this string hello world is actually prints on your screen. Okay, so it is still not finished. It's not done. It's doing I/O at this point. Okay, so it is in the wait state as a result. It will not go to terminate state because it's not done. Okay, yeah, not done yet. It will be done once this I/O is done. Okay, yes, question.
Is there an implicit CPU approval between new and ready?
Is there a implicit CPU?
It doesn't just go from ready to running. It doesn't have to get approval from the CPU or the system call or something.
Yes. So there's a question about this transition. That's a good question. Let me answer it in brief now, and we'll come back to that in a couple of slides. So the question is, when does it go from ready to running? Okay. So suppose that you didn't have a print loop, but you had, let's say, for loop. It says for I, and let's say you do this loop million times. Okay. So it will actually go from ready to running. But let's say this million iterations takes a long time to finish. Okay? What the CPU will do, or rather what the what the OS will do, will say, okay, once you are in running state, I'm going to give you a time slice, let's say 100 milliseconds. Okay? You can run for 100 milliseconds, and if you still need to run, then you need to wait for your turn next, because I have to run other processes as well. So that's what happens. That's why there is a transition back. So let's say maybe it does the first 10,000 iterations, 100 milliseconds elapse. Okay? Then the OS actually has to, process has to give up the CPU. Okay? Which means but it's still ready to run. I mean, it can do a lot more iterations. There are several hundred thousand iterations to go, so it will go back to ready. Okay? Some other process will run. And then later on, it will be this process's turn again to get time on the CPU. So it will go back to running. It will do, let's say, 10,000 more iterations. It will go back to ready. So it will keep looping. Okay? And once it's done with those million iterations, then it will go to terminate. Okay? So that is what causes it to go from ready to running. If you use up the time slice that's allocated to you, which is referred to as a quantum, okay, then you have to give up the CPU because your time is up. Okay, you have to give time to some other processes, and then when the OS says it's your turn next, then you get to go back to run. So some other question somewhere. Yes.
It was actually kind of similar to the previous one. So the situation where when the process goes to waiting is only like when the system calls are.
Okay, so when do you go to waiting? That's the question, right? So in this case, it was just doing some iteration. Let's say it was doing computation. So there's no I/O. So there's no reason to go to waiting. You just switch between ready and running and so on. Okay? Now here you have to do any I/O. Okay? Any I/O which says read from this file, read from this keyboard, take keyboard input, write to a file, write to the screen. Okay? All of these are I/O operations. Okay? If you do any I/O operation whatsoever, that requires you to go to system, the wait state. Okay? Now as I mentioned last time, okay, these I/O operations in turn trigger system calls internally. Okay, so here printf is a library function that just says print this on the screen. So you might have println in Java as an equivalent thing. This itself is not a system call. This is a library function. Now when you call this function, it will in turn trigger a system call. Okay? Indirectly a system call will cause you to go to the wait state. Okay? But that's not important at this point in time. What is important is the process doing I/O or is it doing computation? If it is doing any I/O whatsoever, you have to go to waiting state. That's more important to keep in mind. Okay?
If there is no I/O, it just goes to terminated?
If there is no I/O, it will continue to run until you are done. Either the user has actually said quit, or there's nothing to do, so it will basically reach the end of the program and it will stop. Okay. So it will loop through this until there is nothing more to do. At that point, you go to terminate state. Okay? Is that clear? What's happening here?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's finish this. So here we are in printf. So we are still in wait state. Okay? So let's assume the printf is done. Okay, so then what happens? It goes back to ready. Remember, there's nothing to do, but the OS doesn't know that yet. It just saw the process trying to do an I/O instruction, and the I/O instruction was printf, it's done, so it will go back to ready state. Okay, it will wait for its turn to execute on the CPU. The OS will then give it some CPU time. It will start running on the CPU, then it will go to the next instruction. There isn't any. Okay, this is the last instruction of the program, so the process will terminate at this point, which will cause it to go to terminate state. So you will go from ready to run, then you will go to terminate. Okay? And at that point, the whole process will finish. Yes, question
there. Is there a transition from waiting state to running state?
Is there a transition from waiting state to running state? So you will see that is the state transition diagram. The arrow only goes this way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't automatically go back.
So
Okay. And the reason for this is when you're done with I/O, you have to wait for your turn. You can't just take over the CPU. There may be something else running on the CPU. Okay. So you go back to the ready state, you wait for your turn, and then you run. Okay. So that's the reason there is not I/O that goes back. Yes.
The printing actually happens on the second
run. The print happens here. Okay, so you are in wait state, you are doing I/O, you will actually, the printer will trigger a system call. The system call will cause that string to appear on your screen. All that will happen. Once that is done, you will come back to ready state. Okay? Yes?
Something that is very interesting is how it allocates the time that is required for a particular process. Because in the first instruction, there were some more instructions to be executed. But after the wait state, there is actually no instruction. So the OS has to have a way of determining what is the quantum of time.
Yeah. So question is, what is the amount of time you get in the running state? We'll come back to that when we talk about context switch in just a moment. Most operating systems give a fixed quantum. Okay? You get 100 milliseconds in Linux as an example. Okay? You may get 10 milliseconds on some other machines like OS X. I mean, it's anywhere between 10 to 100 milliseconds. It is fixed. Okay? Doesn't mean you have to use 100 milliseconds. In this case, you got 100 milliseconds. There was nothing to execute. Okay? So you immediately terminate. Your time is up, there's nothing to do, so you just gave up your remaining quantum and somebody else will you run on the CPU. Okay? So it will not, the OS is not going to dynamically decide how much time to give you. If you get to run, you get 100 milliseconds or whatever the OS has decided is the length of your quantum or your time slice. Okay? So that's how it works. Because the OS doesn't really know what the process is doing. It doesn't go look at the instruction. It just gives, lets the process do whatever it wants. Okay, so is that clear what how this works? So these are the state transition state transitions that you make. It's also here. Okay, so you go from new ready running waiting ready running terminate. Okay, very simple program, but this should give you an indication of how it's supposed to work. Okay, in general how any process works. Okay. So we will come back to time slicing in just a moment, but because we are talking about processes, is one important data structure to keep in mind. Whenever your any new process starts up, when it's in the new state, the OS sets up some data structures that are maintained in the kernel that keeps track of all of the state of the process. Okay? All the state of the process is basically what I showed you on the previous slide. So there's a data structure with all of this information in it. And then the kernel has to keep that data structure. This is referred to as a process control block or the PCB. Okay? So it's a OS data structure that keeps track of all active processes in the system. Okay? So this is how the kernel knows anything about that process. Okay? Saying what region of memory does it reside in, what is its current state, what is the state of its register, and so on. So, whenever a process starts up, there is a new PCB that is created. Okay? And there is a queue of PCBs that the process, the kernel maintains, and that tells it about all of the processes in the system. So, there is one process control block entry for every process in the system. And there's a queue of them that the OS kernel is going to maintain. When your process is done, when it goes to terminate state, it is going to deallocate this entry because it doesn't need to keep track of it anymore. Okay? These are all the fields in the process control block entry for a process. Okay? Process state, okay, the OS needs to know is it in running, waiting, and so on. There's a process ID or a process number for every process. There's a program counter, okay, that tells what instruction is being executed. These are all register information. Okay, so they are also kept in the process control block. There's memory management information. There's the owner of the process. Okay, this tells how much memory is allocated, what region of RAM is allocated to the process. There's a queue of pointers. I'll come back to this in just a second. There's scheduling information. What's the priority of the process? How much CPU time has it already used up? Okay. How much CPU time is it using? There's I/O status of the process. Does it have any pending I/O? If so, on what device? Is it doing I/O on disk? Is it trying to read from a CD? All of that is kept in the process control block. Okay. So this is the data structure that is in the kernel. This is how kernel knows about processes. There's one for every process in the system in the kernel. When you create an entry, when or create one of these things every time a process is created, and this lives on through the lifetime of the process. When the process terminates, this entry is deleted for that corresponding process. Okay. So there are some entries here, and it will become clear why you need these entries. Why are the states of registers in the process control block, for instance? Okay, so we'll talk about that just in a second. Okay. But before I do that, I just want to show you some glimpse of how all of these states are actually handled by the kernel. Okay. So the OS maintains the process control blocks of all the processes in what are called state queues. For each of those states that I just showed you, okay, for each of these states there is a queue. Okay. There's a wait queue, there's a ready queue, there's a run queue, there's a terminate queue, and there's a new queue. Depending on what state a particular process is in, it will be in the appropriate queue. If there's a process doing wait, it will be in the wait queue. Okay, so there's a queue, so that tells the OS what are all the processes that are waiting, okay, to do IO. If there are processes, if a process is ready to run, it will be in the ready queue. That tells the kernel what are all the processes that are waiting for their turn to run on the CPU. Okay? If a process is running, it will be in the run queue, in the running queue. Okay? If there's only one core on your system, there can be only one entry in the run queue, because at any time only one process can run. If you have a multi-core system, okay, there will be one entry for each core in the system. So if you have two core system, there can be at most two entries in the running queue, because there can be no more than two processes that can run on these two cores. Okay. But there can be arbitrary number of entries in the ready or waiting queue. Okay. But in the run, the size of the run queue is limited to the number of cores or the processors on your system. Okay. And then the terminate queue, of course, these are all the processes that are finished, that are just waiting for their RAM to be deallocated and the PCB to be deallocated. Okay. So there is one queue for each state, okay, and the OS places the process in the appropriate state execution queue. Whenever the process makes a transition, when it makes a transition from, let's say, ready to run, what the OS kernel does is it takes the PCB entry from that ready queue and it will move it to the run queue. If the process makes a transition from run to wait, the OS will then move the PCB entry from the run to the wait queue, and so on. Okay? So this is how the OS keeps track of what process. Here is an example. Okay, that's a ready queue and that's a wait queue. In this case, it's shown as a doubly linked list. These are individual processes and their corresponding PCB entries. Okay? So this shows you that there are three processes that are ready. Okay, they are just waiting for their turn on the CPU, X, L, and A. Okay. Here are two processes that are doing I.O. at this point in time. Okay. When one of this finishes with their I.O., it will move into the ready queue. It will move to the end of the ready queue and it will wait for its turn. Okay. What the OS will do is it will take each entry from the head, it will move it to the run queue, run it, okay, and then it can either go back to the tail of the queue, okay, or it will move to the wait state depending on which transition it makes. Okay. Or if it finishes, it will move to the terminate queue. So there are these queues that the OS kernel will maintain, okay, which will tell it what are all the processes that are waiting to do I.O., which are ready to run, which are running, which are new, and so on. Okay. So for each state transition that the process makes, the process control blocks moves from the one of these queues to some other queue. Okay, that's what the OS will do internal to keep track of what is happening. Clear? Any questions here? Okay. So now let's come back to the notion of a time slice and so on. Okay. So, I think there's some typo there. It's not starting and stopping processes. It's when a process moves from the ready queue to the run queue and vice versa, you have what is called a context switch. Okay. So what happens is, let's say there is some process that is currently running on the CPU. Okay. So this process, when its time slice expires or it basically blocks on doing I.O., it gives up the CPU. Okay? So at that point, the OS has to choose some other process to run. Okay? So it will pick one from the ready queue and say, now it's your turn. Okay? Now the process of actually allowing a new process to run and suspending a current process is referred to as a context switch, because they're switching between one from one process to another. Okay? So there are lots of things that you have to do, you know, internally in order to actually let a process run or suspend a process that was already running and move it back into the ready queue or the wait queue. Okay, and all of this is referred to as a context switch. Okay, so what happens during a context switch is as follows. So the process that was currently running, the one that is about to give up its CPU, so you have to take all of the process state and put it into the process control block. Okay, so all of the register values, okay, have to be taken from the registers and they have to be copied into the process control block, which is why the process control block has entries for registers. Okay. And the process that is now actually going to start running, you take its values from the register values from the process control block, you load them into the register. You take the program counter value that you saved in the process control block, you load that into the program counter register. You take the stack pointer value that was saved here, load it into the stack pointer register. Once all the register values are loaded, at that point you can actually begin execution. Okay. So you have to, whenever you switch from one process to another, you have to take all of its state, which is the register state, move it, copy it into the process control block, so that when you resume execution subsequently, you can begin exactly where you left off. All the register values appear as if you had never left the CPU in the first place. Okay. So you have to do this saving of state and restoring of state. Okay. These are the operations that you have to do during a context switch. Okay. So that's what it's saying. When a process is running, you modify all of these registers. When you suspend a process, you have to save the current values of the registers to the PCB. Okay. The process of saving the state of the current process and loading the state of the new process is referred to as a context switch. This is going to take some overhead, okay, because you are actually copying from registers to memory, which is the memory of the process control block, and back. Okay. So any context switch is going to incur a small overhead for the operating system. Okay, once you have paid this overhead, then the process that you have loaded now is ready to run. It will actually run for some point in time. Okay, that is referred to as a quantum or a time slice that are given to that process. Okay, so a typical time sharing system may do anywhere from, actually it should be 10 to 1000 now with today's hardware. So you may do 10 to 1000 context switches every second. Okay. That means that you are actually switching between anywhere from 10 to 1000 processes every second. So there are that many context switches you have to perform. Okay. And then the remaining time is spent in actually running all of these processes. Okay. So the cost of a context switch and the time between the switches are closely related. Because you have to pay a certain cost to do a context switch, you want to amortize that cost by giving a sufficient time slice to the process so that it will do useful work. Context switch is not useful work. Okay, this is just bookkeeping as far as the system is concerned. You are not actually making any progress as far as applications are concerned. So the real progress actually happens when the process is actually running. Okay, so once you have paid the cost of a context switch, you want to amortize that over a relatively large time slice so that you can do some useful work for every wasted operation you do in your context switch, wasted or bookkeeping operation that you do. So when we do CPU scheduling in a couple of lectures, we will come back to how do you choose your time slice appropriately. And it depends on the cost of a context switch on the system. Okay, for now, we will not discuss that, but we will come back to this. Okay. Is this clear? What is a context switch? Okay, is another important context, another important thing to keep in mind. Okay, what is it and how does it work? Okay, so we talked about process execution states. We talked about switching from one process to another and what bookkeeping does the OS do to make that happen. Okay, the next thing we are going to now discuss is how processes get created in the system. Okay, so the way a process gets created is that some other process has to initiate its creation. Processes don't appear magically. Okay, there are any a new process can be created by some existing process in the system. Okay? What that also means is there is always what is called a parent-child relationship between processes in the system. Any process in the system is going to have a parent. That's the process that created it. Okay? If this process subsequently creates other processes, it will have child processes and so on. So processes in your system are always arranged hierarchically. Okay, depending on which process created which other process. Okay, so it all begins at boot time. Okay, in the boot time, the kernel loads up and it creates a Unix process called an init process. This is basically the grandparent of all processes in the system. It is how all processes get created. The init process is the one that starts off other things in the system. It might start off networking services, it may start off system daemons, and then it will start off your login prompt and whatnot. Okay? So then when you log in, your login prompt process will actually create some other processes for you that will allow you to log in and do whatever else you want. Okay. So just to show you this process hierarchy, you can actually go into any system and look it up. Okay. So I'll show you on two different systems. So on a Mac, you have to go into this thing called Activity Monitor. These are all the processes on the system. Okay. That's the process ID that I was talking about. Okay. That's in the process control block. It uniquely identifies every process in the system. Okay. So now if you want to see what is the process hierarchy, okay, what you do basically is you go here. You say all processes hierarchically. Yes, so now if you actually close that, so you'll see that that's kernel task is the kernel. Okay, that's process number 0. That's what starts up the system. Okay, and it basically creates this process number 1, which in Mac OS X is called launchd. In Unix systems, it's called init. Okay, it's basically the process that initializes or launches other processes. So that's the process that's basically started. So if you actually that's collapsed. So if you do this, it will show you that launch process actually started up several system services. Okay, there's the audio service and there's a networking service and whatnot here. So if you actually scroll through, you'll see there's a whole bunch of services that have been started. There's also a login service. Okay, so when you log in, just a second, when you log in, you will add this process will actually spawn some other processes. So let's see. When I logged in, that process actually, there's a launch process for me because that's a user that started. And that basically is what starts off all of my processes. Okay, so these are all the processes that I am running. It includes my browser. So that process is the one that has started all these others. So that's your process hierarchy on this machine. Yes, question there.
Can a parent process terminate without a child process terminating?
Yeah, good question. The question is, can a parent process terminate without a child process terminating? This is allowed in Unix system. So if your parent actually terminates, you basically your default parent and becomes either your grandparent, or by default you go back and launchd becomes your default parent. So basically you don't have really a parent, so you have to be given some parent. Okay, so you just get some parent, and that depends on the system. Okay, so this is basically the process hierarchy in OS X. You can find out the process hierarchy on other systems. So here is this is a Linux machine. So if you actually type this command called ps3, so this ps tells you the list of all processes. Ps3 says print it out as a tree. Okay, so here is your tree. So you will see a hierarchy here. So here is your init process. Okay. So this init process has started all these other processes. These are mostly system processes. Okay, there is auditd and there is the whole bunch of them. And then this shows you that this process started this process, that process started this other process. So here is a mail server that got started by this processes and so on. So if you scroll down somewhere, you will see that there's some login process that... Okay, so this is me logging into the system. I SSH'd into the system, so that created a shell prompt. I typed ps3. Okay, so my shell actually started this process, which is printing this output incidentally. Okay, so it actually shows itself as well in the hierarchy. So you'll see that this is basically the process hierarchy in your system. Okay, so the thing to keep in mind is there's a parent-child relationship between every process. So typically whenever you have a shell prompt and you type some command, it starts a process. So your shell is the one that is spawning other processes. Okay, so that's your parent process. Okay, so now we know that a process has to be created by some other process, and that's the parent of this process. And then the other new process is called a child. Okay, so how is that actually done? Okay, how does a parent process create a child process? This is done using a system call, and that system call in Unix is called fork. Okay, in Windows it's called create process. They do equivalent things. So I'm only going to talk about fork here. Okay, so you can create a process. Okay, you can write an application that creates its own process, child process. And the way you do this is in your application, in your code, you have to call the fork system call. If you call fork, it will start a new child process for you. Okay? So typically, what happens, so there are these two calls that are important that start any, that used to start new processing. So you call fork, this creates a child process, and then you have exec, which causes any process to execute something. Okay? So with these two system calls, you can basically create, or any process can create any other process and then cause it to start executing some program. Okay? And I'll show you what that, how that works. Okay? So let's start with fork. What does fork do? Okay? Or how does fork create a new process? So I think I have a, maybe some. Okay, so let me just give you this example, then we'll come back to fork. So when you log into, I showed you this process tree. So when you log into a machine, it creates your login process. Will create a shell process for you. Okay, if you're logging, let's say doing SSH. So this shell process is what appears as your bash prompt or C shell prompt and so on. Every time you type a command, this shell process will then start up a new child process, and then it will, using fork, so you create a new child process, and then you to the exec system call, you will pass in the command you actually type. So if you do ls, it says show me all the files on this machine, you will do a fork, and then within exec you will execute ls. Okay, then the ls program will start executing, it will print its output, and then it will terminate. Okay, so everything you type, any command you type, forks a new process, and then within that child process you execute the name of the command you typed or the name of the application you are trying to execute. Okay, and once it is done, then you go back to your shell prompt. This is just an example of how things work in Unix. So let's come back to how fork actually works. How does it create this new process, and then how exec actually works? How does it start executing something? So let's talk about fork. So I'm going to write pseudo code here. Okay, so let's say, so there are arguments here which we will ignore. Okay. So if you just do that, if you say fork, this process, and when this process is executing and executes this system call, it will create a new process. So what does, what happens? So let's assume this is actually the memory layout of this process. Okay, you are here. Yeah, this is a process that's currently executing. This is the parent process. Okay, so within this parent process, you have called a fork. So when you call fork, what the OS does is it creates a exact clone of that process. It just takes everything this process has, creates a duplicate. Okay, so your child process, when you just created it using fork, is an exact replica of the parent. Okay, so it will take this memory content, and just copy it into another region, create a new process control block for this process. So your child looks exactly what, like the parent. Okay. So, because the OS doesn't know what the child should do, so the only thing it does is let the child look like the parent. So it will just take this and it will create an exact replica. So at this point, you have two processes. These are distinct processes that are executing the exact same code. Okay, but they are distinct processes. They have their distinct memory allocated to them. From this point on, the parent and the child can do different things because they are independent processes. There's a parent-child relationship between them, but as far as the OS is concerned, they are independent things. They can do whatever they want. Okay? So typically, in the, you know, let's say if this was a shell prompt, the shell prompt would do a fork, and then within the child, you will actually do an exec, and then let's say you type ls, so you will do this. Okay, so this will, what this will do when the exec call does is, it will take this program, okay, it will load this program and overwrite this memory contents with this program, and it will actually start executing that process. Okay? Yes, question.
What does the exec get there?
Okay, so I'll talk about that in just a second. Yeah, good question, because I haven't actually written code here. I'm just giving concepts here. Okay, so first thing is, you do a fork, create a clone. Child process looks exactly like the parent. Okay, but child process is free to do whatever it wants. So in this case, the child process may do something different from the parent. In particular, the child will say, I want to do exec. What does the exec do? Okay, exec is actually going to take this memory region, basically essentially wipe it out and load this new program in there and start executing that program. So until now the two are identical. As soon as you do exec, this looks nothing like the parent. This will actually be a process that is executing this command. And the parent is doing something else here. But until you do exec, they are identical. Is that clear? Any question on that? Yes.
Did you say wipes out that parent?
Yes.
Or do you mean that it makes a new one?
No, it doesn't make a new one. This is the child process. It actually replaces this process, the code for this process, with the code for that program. So it is actually wiping it out and it is just replacing all of that code and it will start executing that. Yes, question.
So where is the exact parameter or the command is stored? If it wipes it off, it has to be stored somewhere so that it can put it back somewhere.
There is no putting it back. Once you wipe it out, this process is gone. It is actually on that process.
But the exec is also in the command.
Yeah, so this exec actually has to be in the code here for it to be here. Right, so I'll talk about, so you're asking good question. Let me come back to why that exec was appeared there, and it has to actually be in the original code. But it is not executed here, it's only executed there. So we'll come to that in just 1 second. Okay, just hold off on that. So I haven't filled out the rest of this, but I'm just providing you concept of what is fork and what is exec. Fork creates a clone of a process. Exec takes whatever process it is actually executing and replaces it with whatever you pass in the argument. And that process basically, this process turns into that process. It's not going to create yet another process. This is the process. It will just take this memory region, load this process and start executing. Okay? What happens to the state of the process? Nothing happens. I mean, this is the process control block, right? So when you load up the new memory region, it will still have, it will start executing this LS thing from the beginning. So you will, basically that is the state of the process. Okay? Now there's a question of what happened to this exec, where did it come from, what is the state of it and so on. So we'll now talk about how the parent and the child do different things. How does the child know it is the child? Okay, and that it has to do this, and how does the parent know it's the parent and it does not have to do that? Okay, as far as this is the same code, right? This is the code that you as a programmer wrote. Okay, and then your child is actually going to be when you create a clone of it, it is actually going to be the same code. So there must be something that causes the child to behave differently from the parent, because at this point they're exactly identical. It has the same code loaded, but they do different things. Yes, question. Yes, so exactly. So there's a suggestion that the process ID is going to tell the two processes who is the parent and who is the child. So let me actually show you some sample code here. Okay. So this is very simple. There is no exec here. This is just a process that creates a child process. The child process prints something, okay, and then it quits. Okay. So here is how it works. So here you basically go and you do a fork. And then the fork actually returns you a value. Okay? Now it turns out that the only difference, although I said these two processes are exactly identical, they are not exactly identical. There's just one subtle difference, and the difference is what is the return value of the fork. Okay? The fork knows who is the parent and who is the child. Okay? And to let these processes know who is the parent and who is the child, the fork is going to return two different values depending on who is the parent and who is the child. In the parent process, the fork is going to return you the process ID of the child that has just been created. Okay, so the parent knows what process was created when it executes fork. Okay. In the child, the same fork call, it's the same code. This is the same code that the child is also going to execute, because when you create a clone, the child actually is executing the same code, so it is executing the fork. I mean, it has just written, the fork is going to be present in the child as well. But the fork is actually going to return a zero in the child. Okay, this is the definition of how fork works. It creates a clone. In the parent, the return value of the fork is the process ID of the child. In the child, the return value is zero. Okay? So the child can figure out it is a child by just examining what return value came back from fork. okay, if the return value is zero, it knows it's a child, so it can do something. If the return value is non-zero, that process knows it's the parent. Okay, so that's exactly what happens. So you basically write an if rule, if condition. You're saying if that return value is zero, you know that's a child process, then you can do something. Okay? If the return value is not zero, you know you are the parent. So the parent, from this point on, the two behave differently because the child is actually going to execute this code. That's in the if condition. The parent is going to execute the else part. Okay? Yes, Washington.
How do you do another child from the child?
Okay, so how do you do another child? Good question. Okay, possible exam question. So how do you do another child? So basically the question is, you want to have a process that creates a child, and you want the child to have another spawn of another child process. So how would you do this? Okay, so I think you can just use the concept and do this, right? So okay, so first you have to do a fork. This is all pseudocode. You don't need to write exact C code here. Okay. Then you say if, let's call it process ID. This is child. Okay. This is the parent. So what do we know? We know that after this fork, the child is going to execute whatever code you put in this part. And you know that the parent is going to execute whatever code you do in this part. Okay. If you want the child to create another child, what would you do? You would basically just do the same thing in here. Okay. You would basically do a fork here. Okay, we'll call it the grandchild. Then again you will basically say if grandchild ID equal to 0, this is your grandchild code. The else is your child code. Okay, is that clear? Okay. You could have said let the parent create two children, not one. Okay. So in that case you would actually do the first fork, and then the child is free to do something else. This is the parent. And the second fork will happen in here. Okay, then the parent will spawn a second child. Okay, is that clear what I just said? Yes, no? No. Okay. Yes, you have a question before I...
For the exec command, you said that it wipes the whole thing, so anything after exec would not be read.
Anything after exec not read. Okay. Because there's nothing to do. It's basically wiped out. Good point. Because it's going to stop executing that program and start executing something else. Okay. So question was, how do you have a process that creates two children? So we saw an example where you have a process that creates a child, child creates grandchild. Okay, so the process tree is process A, process B, process tree. C. That's the process hierarchy here. What if you want this hierarchy? Parent creates two children. Okay. It's all very simple. You always have to start with this template. Okay. First you have to create some child. Okay, so let's say A creates this fork that creates child B. Okay, so this is your code for B. Okay. A wants to create another child C. Okay, where would you put that fork? That's clearly a second fork. Where would you put that fork? You have to put it here because this child shouldn't execute that fork, so you have to basically have that fork here. Okay, so this is going to create another child. So here again you have to have your if this process ID equal to 0, that's the code for C, otherwise you are back in the code for A. Okay? So assume that I can ask you in either in homework or an exam question, say okay, you want to create a scenario where you have a process that creates another process that creates two children. How would you, what fork combination would you use? Okay, so you have to then decide where to place this appropriate fork. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. Okay. Now typically, as I was mentioning, you will actually have an exec that goes with the fork, although in this example, it was just process creation. So in the child, if the child had to have do an exec and do an ls, then this is what you would do here. So then this child process will start executing no longer this program, but it will start executing a new program. Okay? That's basically how this fork and exec are used. Any questions on this? Yes, there's a question.
So if the exec started another process, instead of having the fork in the if statement, so that's all the same structure as the first example, the A and B to C?
Yes, so exec, this just basically doesn't change B. Its process ID is the same. You basically, the B is just now a different program. It's not executing this code, it's executing a different code. The hierarchy is not going to change. Instead of running this code, it will basically run the code for the LS program. It will load that program and start executing it. Okay, just that the memory contents are changed. That's all. Okay, so exec doesn't change the parent-child relationship. It just causes the child to start executing a different program. This is the only way you can actually start other programs. With an exec. First I have to create a child and tell the child go do that. Okay, you said go start a browser. So you'll say exec Firefox. Okay, go start Word. You will basically fork and in the exec you'll say start Word. Okay, that's how you can start other processes in the system. Yes, question there.
Is it impossible for processes to run at the same time?
Is it impossible for the processes to run at the same time? Whether processes run at the same time or not, I don't know exactly what you mean by the same time. Are you saying they execute in parallel?
Simultaneously.
If you have multiple cores on your system, each core can execute a program independently of the other core. Okay? So it is more than possible for the parent to be on core 1. You fork, create a new process, that process starts executing on core 2. They are running at the same time. If you have only one core, you have to wait for your turn. This child process will actually start off in the new state, it will go back to the ready state, it will wait for its turn because the processor is still executing the parent. Okay? And then at some later point it will go into the running state. So that's how it will work if you have only one processor. But if you have more than one, it could well execute in parallel. Okay? Any other questions here? Okay, so there's one more call I just want to talk about, which is the wait PID call. Okay? Wait PID call causes this process to wait until whatever process ID you have specified, that process actually finishes. Okay? So in this case, what we have done is we have forked off a child process. Child process is just doing an exec here actually. Okay, so it is going to execute that program. And the parent, is all that it is doing is it's going to wait for that child process to finish. So wait PID or just the wait call in general just waits for whatever process you have specified in the argument. Once that process terminates, then this wait is going to return. So this will cause the parent to block until this child ID, which is that program, actually finishes. So in this case, what has happened is you created a child, you wait for the child to finish execution, okay, by using the wait call. This is the third call that you can use for coordinating across processes. There's fork, exec, and there's wait. Okay, so you wait for the child and then you print saying that process has finished. Okay? Typically a shell prompt actually does this. This is a trivial shell, and if you just put a loop around this, that's exactly what the shell does. Shell waits for you to type a command. Okay? It creates a fork, and then in the exec part of the child, it will actually pass the arguments you gave. Okay? So then that process begins execution, and then the shell, which is the parent process, actually waits for that program to finish. Once it finishes, then it actually puts out a new prompt for you, and it does this in a loop. Okay? So this is actually what a shell prompt on a Unix machine will do. Yes, question.
Does the child automatically tell its parent that's finished?
Okay. Does the child automatically tell its parent? You will see that there's nothing the child is doing to tell its parent. Okay? The OS is the one that can tell the process, because the OS knows. So when you do a wait, you send this process ID. This is a system call. This tells the OS saying, this process, the parent process, is actually going to wait until that process is going to finish. You don't have to wait for your child. You can wait for any arbitrary process. Okay? It's just a process ID. In this case, you just happen to wait for your child. Okay, so it tells the OS saying, this process is waiting. So it will block. It will be in your wait queue. Okay? Once that process actually finishes, then this wait will return. And if the system or kernel put it back into the ready queue, then the parent knows that the child has finished. Okay. Okay, yes, question.
Is there a way that the child process knows who is its parent?
Is there a way for the child process to know who its parent is? Not directly. Because the fork doesn't tell you who your parent ID is. It only returns zero. Okay. So the parent will know who the child is. The child automatically will not know who your parent is. There's a way to find out. I mean, you can use other system calls to say who is my parent and what not. But by default, it will not know just based on what the fork is telling.
Generally, there wouldn't be a situation where the child process has to wait till the parent has to finish or something like that.
Yeah, so typically you don't, child don't wait for the, it's usually the reverse. Of course, you can do it. It's not that there is a problem. But then you have to figure out who your parent is and then wait for the parent. Because this wait PID can wait on any arbitrary process. It doesn't have to wait for a child process. But you have to find out who your parent is or which process you want to wait on. It doesn't even have to be a parent. It could be any arbitrary process. You have to find its process ID somehow. Okay? So three things to keep in mind. Fork, exec and wait. Okay, by using fork, exec and wait, you can actually coordinate creation of a process, causing the child to execute something for the parent to wait on the child or parent to wait on the grandchild. You can do any combination of these by putting the fork, exec and wait in the appropriate places. Okay? Okay, so I already showed you this here. Okay, this is just saying that when you do a fork, you just create a copy of that process, and when the only thing that is different between the child and the parent is what value the fork returns. Okay, in the child it is going to return 0, in the parent it is going to return the process ID of the child that was created. Okay, but otherwise they look identical, and subsequently if you do exec, then they no longer, the memory contents will no longer look identical, because you will basically load a new program in your child. Okay. The last thing is how does, so that was how process creation works. Right? Process termination, very simple. You can call exit. That's a system call that terminates the process. You can externally terminate any process using the kill system call. Okay. Kill is an external way to terminate a process. Exit is an internal way to terminate a process. Okay. So in the, if you go back to, so this code that I showed you here, the one line code. Okay, when the although there is no exit here, when you compile the code, your compiler has actually put an exit code there. This is how the process actually terminates. Okay. So you don't have to necessarily put exit. Of course, you could put exit here and then cause the process to explicitly exit. But if you don't do that, your compiler will actually, as the last line of your program, it will automatically put an exit, which will call the exit system call. So this is how the program will exit. Okay, so you can do exit or you can do kill. I presume you know how kill works. I mean, if your process hangs, you do alt control delete, you basically get a list of processes, you terminate one. Okay? That's just a GUI way of doing kill. You can do the same thing on any so if you actually go into a terminal. I'm sorry? No. You can kill whatever process you want. If you have the right privileges. If you try to kill a system process, you are a user, it won't let you kill it. Right? So if I try to kill, if I do kill 0, which is I'm trying to kill the kernel here, it will basically not do anything. I mean, it hasn't stopped the machine. Right? But you can kill yourself. Right? So if I go and kill, this is the shell prompt, that's the process ID. It will basically just log me out. So I'm going to do kill -9, which is just an argument. 2, 2, 4, 3, 6. So you can kill children. So long as the privileges to do it, you can kill whatever process you want. So it basically killed itself. Right? And then in activity monitor, you basically all you do is you pick something and then you do quit process. This basically quit process is going to call the kill system call and kill that process. Okay, so you just have to give process ID as the argument. Okay, that's how kill works. Okay, so this is basically just the same program, but there's an exit and a kill here. Okay, so basically, it waits for something and it kills the child process. Okay, just sample code that shows you how kill works. Because you have the process ID, you can just call this kill with that process ID, it terminates that process. Okay. Any question there? Okay. So I have few minutes. So that's basically how processes are created, how processes are terminated. Okay, that should tell you how this process hierarchy is formed and what not. Okay, in the system. Every process has to basically initiate the creation of some other process. That subsequent to its creation, that process can launch its own program using the exec call. Okay, and then you can manage processes by using the kill system call. Okay, so now what we are going to talk about is this notion of cooperating processes, which is how processes can cooperate or communicate with one another. Okay. Given any two arbitrary processes in the system, okay, this pair of processes is either called independent or it is cooperating. If these processes have nothing to do with one another, okay, they don't care about one another, they don't communicate with one another, they are called independent processes. Okay. But if it so happens that these processes are working with one another in some way to accomplish some task, then you have this notion of a cooperating processes. Okay. And there are many scenarios where we want cooperation. We'll see several in the next few classes. Today we'll just do a simple producer-consumer types thing. Okay, so cooperating processes can enhance performance by doing things in parallel. Okay. It enables better structure by having a set of cooperating processes. So if you look at the things like the Google Chrome browser, okay, every tab you create in Google Chrome is actually an independent process. Okay, on certain systems. Okay. And these processes are all cooperating with one another to display what is on your screen. Okay, so each tab is its own process. In other systems that may not be, for Firefox you may not do that. You actually, each tab may be a thread. We'll talk about threads next time. Okay. So this basically allows you to share information between processes and so on. Yes, there are questions here.
I have a quick question about that. When you kill one of the processes, that's Google Chrome, it actually kills the whole program. You know, can you explain, like, with this, why it would do that?
So typically, if the way it was originally designed, okay, when you kill something on a tab, it is not supposed to kill the parent process. Because they are independent processes. That was the reason they went with a multi-process architecture. If all tabs are part of the same process, if you have flash or something and it starts misbehaving, if you kill flash, it kills the whole process. Okay? Because once you kill one thread, the whole process goes away. The whole point of the original Google Chrome architecture was if you can kill something in a tab, it shouldn't impact the stability of the browser. So if one tab you have flash running, and yes, basically that's a flash process. You kill it, the rest of it stays as is. Okay? That, as I said, that may not be the way they have implemented it on every single platform. On some platforms, you will find that every tab is an independent process. Okay? So it will actually not kill the whole thing. Okay? But this is not necessarily true of how they have done it everywhere. So if you look at the design of Chrome, it will actually tell you about all of this. Okay? So typically, if you have seen that you kill some tab, it kills the whole browser process. That means on that platform it does not use the multi-process cooperating process architecture. Okay, that's all it says. Yes.
I was going to ask, is that why they chose one process just so you can kill like individual things?
Yes.
It is
more secure. Right? So there are many reasons. Stability, security were the two reasons. Stability just says I have 10 tabs open. In one tab I have flash or some script running. It is misbehaving. I don't want to kill the whole browser. If I just terminate that misbehaving component, rest of my browser stays as it. This is one thing. The second thing is security, right? So you may visit inadvertently a site that has actually downloaded malware into your browser. Okay? In another tab, you are actually logged into your bank account. Okay? Now this malware, if it's the same process, it has access to the whole memory. Okay? It can actually go and look at any memory region, including whatever the page that is being shown for your bank account, and steal that information. If there are two independent processes, this tab cannot look at what this other tab is doing. So you may be logged into your bank in another tab. It's independent process, different memory region, OS provides you memory protection, so it cannot actually go and do anything. Okay, so there are several reasons why they chose that. So these are the two. Any other questions here? Okay, so cooperating processes is basically where you can have processes communicate or cooperate with one another to achieve some task. Okay, so we will talk about So I'm just going to present this example and then resume the discussion next time. So this is the notion of producers and consumers. Yeah, first question is, has anyone heard about producers and consumers? What is a producer-consumer system? Who has heard of it? Okay, maybe it's a very small fraction of people have heard. So producers and consumers are basically, it's a generic way of writing applications of cooperating processes. Yeah, so the way it works is that there are two processes, actually not two, but more than, could be arbitrary number, but at least two. Okay. One process is called a producer, the other process is called a consumer. What they share between them is a buffer. Okay, it's a piece of memory. Okay. Producers can produce data items. What is data item is not material here. They can produce some data, and whenever you produce a data, you add it to the shared buffer. Okay. Consumers consume data from the shared buffer. So whenever there's something to consume, the consumer will actually take it from the shared buffer and process it. Okay? So this is a way for these two processes to do something, okay, or to cooperate with one another using the shared buffer. Okay? So producers by definition produce data, stick it into the buffer. You always put things at the tail, and the consumers always consume. So there may be more than one data items here. And the producers will consume whatever is in the, rather consumers will consume whatever is in the buffer from the head. Okay, so you can basically let these two run arbitrarily, and producers can keep producing, consumers can run at later time. There can be more than one producer and more than one consumer. So it's just a single producer, single consumer example. Okay, but you can have arbitrary number that all share this buffer. Okay, and then there can be more than one consumer here. Okay, that's the code. Pseudo code for producers and consumers. Okay? So first you have to say whether your buffer is finite or infinite. That's a finite buffer, producer consumer. It says the buffer can hold at most 100 data items. That's n equals 100. Okay? So this is a loop, producer loop, that's the consumer loop. What the producer is doing is it produces a data item. So long as the buffer is not full, stick it at the next available entry in your buffer. Okay? This is actually a circular buffer, as you will see here. Okay? And the consumer does the same thing. It keeps looping and says, so long as the buffer is not empty, go and consume one data item. Okay? And if the producer finds that the buffer is full, it is going to wait. It's going to just loop here until the buffer becomes at least one entry in the buffer is available. And then the consumer does the same thing. If the buffer is completely empty, there's nothing to consume, it will sit and loop. Okay? So it says that this is the condition that says the buffer is empty. This is the condition that says the buffer is full. Okay? So this is the generic producer-consumer problem. Okay? Now this is in abstract. The way we look at cooperating processes is this will be one process, that will be another process. There will be a piece of memory that these processes share, and then you are actually going to put data items into this memory, and then the consumer will actually consume. Okay? We will see how to do this next time. But before you go, I have a very quick exercise here, which is 5 minutes. Okay, we are actually just running out of time. I want two things. One is I want everybody's group information. Yeah, that's the second thing there, because I haven't received that from everyone. If you formed a group, just put that down. And then the other thing I wanted to do is, for this example, I want you to draw me the list of state transitions the program is going to make. Yeah, just based on the, so here are some, if you anybody wants papers, then I have some to give you. So I can even put down. So just to make it even simpler, I just drew the state transition diagram there. So just see what transition that process makes. Good question. So you can assume that that while loop executes in one quantum. Yeah, assume both while loops execute in one quantum each. If you are done, you can hand in and leave quietly without. Shouldn't take more than 5 minutes to do this exercise.
Can you explain the last sentence of question two? I don't know what the word is.
This thing?
Yes.
Oh, it just says if you haven't formed a group, then explain why you didn't form a group.
Okay, well, that part after that. Should be that 1.4.
Oh, that's just a joke. Lethargy just says laziness. Well, whatever your group is, hopefully your group doesn't keep changing, right? I hope, because that will make it more difficult for us.
I don't know what I'm asking.
Okay. Candy here if somebody wants to take some. Yeah, so
what happened? So you do for two child prefetch?
It's a good question. You should think about what will happen. So if you don't put the second fork in any if or else,
uh-huh.
both the parent and the child will both execute.
Right.
But both of them will go to the next statement.
Okay.
So then the child will actually create one more child and the parent will create a second child.
Okay.
So we'll end up with four processes total.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, so I have basically left after this.
So if you basically, yeah, let me just finish this then, okay.